Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hi there, everyone. It's 4 o'clock in New York. His story, it was a quintessentially American one, the product of hardworking immigrant parents. Colin Powell went to college in the 50s, joined the Army, and served honorably in Vietnam, later awarded the Soldier's Medal, the Legion of Merit, the Bronze Star, and not one, but two Purple Hearts. He rose to four-star general and became the first Black chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the youngest, we should add. But his well-earned legacy as a decorated military man is just part of the picture. Because although he would eventually decide against running for president himself, he would become an unrivaled force in American political life all the same. And listening to him talk, it is easy to understand why.
Above all, never lose faith in America. Its faults are yours to fix, not to curse. America is a family. There may be differences and disputes within the family, but we must not allow the family to be broken into warring factions. From the diversity of our people, let us draw strength and not see weakness. Believe in America with all your heart and soul, with all of your mind. Remember that it remains the last best hope of earth.
Powell will go on, of course, to serve as Secretary of State under George W. Bush. But his influence did not diminish after he left that administration as a Republican. Recall the seismic effect of his words in the lead up to another election, the 2008 election.
I think he is a transformational figure. He is a new generation coming into the world, onto the world stage, onto the American stage. And for that reason, I'll be voting for Senator Barack Obama.
It was a political earthquake, and after decades spent providing counsel to some of the most powerful people on planet Earth, Colin Powell did the same thing in retirement, routinely advising American officials, people like the current Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, who mourned his passing from COVID-19 earlier today.
The world lost one of the greatest leaders that we have ever witnessed. Alma lost a great husband. And the family lost a tremendous father. And I lost a tremendous personal friend and mentor. He has been my mentor for a number of years. He always made time for me, and I could always go to him with tough issues. He always had great counsel. We will certainly miss him. I feel as if I have a hole in my heart just learning of this.
Flags at the White House are at half staff through Friday to remember a man already being honored by some as some of the most important elected officials in our country, current and past. In a statement, President Biden said Powell, quote, led with his personal commitment to the democratic values that make our country strong. The Clintons called him, quote, a courageous soldier, a skilled commander, a dedicated diplomat, and a good and decent man. And from President Bush, this, quote, he was such a favorite of presidents that he earned the Presidential Medal of Freedom twice. He was highly respected at home and abroad. Most important, Colin was a family man and a friend. Helping us reflect on his life and his legacy is where we start this hour with former senior advisor to President Obama, Valerie Jarrett, and Ambassador John Negroponte, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, as well as the former deputy national security advisor under Colin Powell during the Reagan administration. Valerie, I'm going to start with you and that political earthquake I mentioned. Let me play a little longer segment of Colin Powell endorsing then Senator Obama back in 2008.
I think back to my Army career. We've got two individuals. Either one of them could be a good president. But which is the president that we need now? Which is the individual that serves the needs of the nation for the next period of time? And I come to the conclusion that because of his ability to inspire, because of the inclusive nature of his campaign, because he is reaching out all across America, because of who he is and his rhetorical abilities, and we have to take that into account, as well as his substance. He has both style and substance. He has met the standard of being a successful president, being an exceptional president. I think he is a transformational figure. He is a new generation coming into the world, onto the world stage, onto the American stage. And for that reason, I'll be voting for Senator Barack Obama.
Valerie Jarrett, I was on the other side of that presidential election contest, and I remember that moment. I remember I was sitting. I remember sitting so still and not breathing because Colin Powell mattered that much. What did that mean to now former President Obama?
Well, I remember the exact same thing, Nicole, where I was sitting at my kitchen table. I did not breathe either. When I finally took a breath, it was a breath of relief, not just that he had said he was going to vote for President Obama, but what he said about President Obama as a leader, the kind of person that Colin Powell believed our country needed at that moment in time. And it's consistent with his life. He was a, you know, barrier breaker. He was a role model. He was a straight shooter. I always say that, you know, he put country first above politics. And I think that's what he was doing at that moment. And as you know, Nicole, as well as anyone, it was seismic for someone with that stature within the Republican Party to endorse a person of the other party at that moment in time. And it did send shockwaves around the country. And I do think it made a difference. So my heart goes out to Alma and the entire Powell family. She shared him with our country in a very gracious way. And I'm sure that there were many moments when she wishes, as all spouses of leaders wish their husbands were not in the front of the cameras in the front line. But what an incredible couple. What an incredible legacy they both have. And she was a big piece of it, too.
You're right about what they give to the country. I think that he was part of an era where he was in that small handful of referees where everything he said mattered to both parties. Obviously, times have changed. One side sort of hostage to disinformation, and that may not be the case now. But he was one of the first people to loudly call out the darkest forces in the Republican Party. And I want to show you something he said about what is widely viewed as one of John McCain's finer moments. But Colin Powell made clear that people on the Republican side should have gone even further. Here he is about questions about whether President Obama was a Muslim.
I'm also troubled by not what Senator McCain says, but what members of the party say. And it is permitted to be said such things as, well, you know that Mr. Obama is a Muslim. Well, the correct answer is he is not a Muslim. He's a Christian. He's always been a Christian. But the really right answer is, what if he is? Is there something wrong with being a Muslim in this country? The answer is no, that's not America. Is there something wrong with some 70-year-old Muslim American kid believing that he or she could be president? Yet I have heard senior members of my own party drop this suggestion. He's a Muslim and he might be associated with terrorists. This is not the way we should be doing it in America.
And I know it pained him greatly to see the direction the Republican Party would head. But a high water mark in terms of sort of policing the rhetoric on one side of the aisle in this country from General Powell there.
Absolutely. And I think our country hungers for those kind of voices. And I hope part of his legacy will be having inspired the next generation of leaders in both parties to appeal to our better angels, to realize that it is one country and we should love our country. And just because we are critical sometimes of our country, that just means we love it all the more and we have a responsibility, which he always emphasized, Nicole, to make it better, each in our own way, each with our own voices and our own platform. That's his legacy. He did that. And I hope that people will feel empowered to do the same.
What do you think about when you see these sort of icons of an era way in the rearview mirror for our country?
Well, it's hard to see them in the rearview mirror, but what inspires me and makes me optimistic, Nicole, is the young people who I meet who are just as kind of idealistic about the country as it should be, who are willing to roll up their sleeves and work hard on a whole range of issues that impact our country, that are willing to sacrifice in order to serve our country. It's an honor to serve, but it's a sacrifice for the individuals as well as for their families. And I do think we have a new generation coming along that wants to pick up that baton and run with it in a way that brings us closer together, as he tried to do. And I hope that those voices will be louder, not in decibel, but in power, than the voices right now trying to pull us apart.
And to be clear, I meant this era is in our rear view mirror. Colin Powell is very much front and center and so of this American moment, calling on our better angels. He would go on after endorsing President Obama, obviously to endorse him a second time and then to endorse Hillary Clinton and to endorse President Biden. Much has been made, and I think Reuters in their obituary writes that he was outmaneuvered by some of the other foreign policy voices in the Bush administration. He certainly used his voice and his stature to advocate for a very different direction in U.S. foreign policy. Was he an influential voice for President Obama?
Yes, he was. And he was available for counsel whenever President Obama wanted. I can remember calling him several times and just picking his brain. He always made room, and he considered that a service to our country. Again, it wasn't about partisan politics for him. It was, could his voice, could his advice, could his years of experience actually make progress, help make progress? And that's what I think our country kind of hungers for right now, is those voices of reason who say, yes, I'm willing to serve. This isn't about me being affiliated with one party or another. And in fact, he said he feels that his party has drifted away from the core values that attracted him to it in the first place. And you know, he received an enormous amount of criticism and pushback for that. But that's what courage is about. It's about standing by your convictions, whether they are popular within your party or not. You think that they are actually what's best for our country. And I think that's what our nation needs right now. More voices like Colin Powell from both parties.
Absolutely. Valerie Jarrett, I'm really grateful to get to talk to you today and to have your thoughts. It's an incredibly sad moment to lose him and to lose that time when one voice could sort of break through all the noise on all sides. Thank you so much for being part of our coverage. I want to bring into our conversation Ambassador John Negroponte. Your thoughts, just listening to this conversation, I want to start out with something more current. Obviously, that interview was from General Powell's endorsement of then-Senator Obama. But I want to show you something he said on the morning of January 7th after the insurrection at the United States Capitol.
I've never seen anything or experienced anything like this in my many years of public service. Yesterday was a national disgrace, but we'll come through it. But once again, we see President Trump doing things that are absolutely outrageous, criminal, claiming that he is going to be the president of the United States when he knows he isn't.
We are less without someone of General Powell's stature in the conversation, saying what needs to be said when it needs to be said.
Well, you know, I agree with what he said there, absolutely. And the part I think is important to emphasize, and was important to emphasize then, is we will come through this. And I think that Colin had an unshakable faith in the United States of America, which he reiterated just about at every opportunity. And I think that's one of the reasons he was such an inspirational figure. For me, he was a wonderful person. He was a wonderful person to deal with. I reported to him three different times in my career as his deputy, as ambassador to the United Nations, and as ambassador to Iraq. He was always there for me. You won't believe this, but when I was ambassador to Iraq and to the United Nations, I spoke to him by phone. He would call me practically every working day of the week, sometimes just to be sure that I was okay. But he was a hands-on leader. He was just terrific to work for. Really, really magnificent.
He's watching from up above. What would he want people to know about those calls or about those conversations or about his concerns for the country? What would he want you to say today?
Well, the first point I think would be the faith in the United States and that the ship can be righted, that some of these aberrations that we've watched are not permanent features of our political landscape. And, you know, you've talked quite a bit about his political involvement, whether he supported this particular candidate or not. I never thought of Colin as a particularly partisan person. He happened to be a Republican, but he was not very proactive politically. He basically believed in professional government service. That was his DNA. That was his background. He'd been in the Army all those decades. And then he went on to be chairman of the JCS and Secretary of State. These are professional governmental jobs, which shouldn't be tainted or unduly influenced by politics. And I think that's basically what he believed, even though, you know, we always talk a lot about whether he supported this candidate or that. But I'm not sure that that was forefront in his mind at all. He wanted people that he worked with and who reported to him and who are working now to do the right thing. Be committed to your country. Be committed to doing a good job. Colin really pursued excellence in every way he could.
It's an important point, and I think maybe it reflects our different vantage points. You know, I spent my career in politics, so I saw the seismic effect of anything he said about politics. But I take your point that it wasn't a driver, but he wasn't drawn to anything about our country's partisan politics. With your point taken, tell me how he came to weigh in, either in 2008 or to speak at presidential conventions. Was it about concern for the direction and who led the country?
Well, I'm not entirely certain, but I suspect so. He had great charisma. He had great public appeal. I mean, why did political leaders why were they attracted to Colin Powell? I think the reason was, among other things, in addition to liking him, I think they recognized how popular he was. I mean, clearly, Mr. George W. Bush brought him into the 2000 campaign because he was hoping that some of Colin's popularity would stick with him. And, you know, the tactic may, in fact, you recall how he traveled all over the country with the candidate, George W. Bush. And it was his immense popularity because of his personality, because of his charisma, and of course, because he had won such a outstanding victory in the first Gulf War.
Mm-hmm. I want to, I think you raise up something that would obviously be important to the family, that he was sort of this unwilling entrant and participant in our very fractured politics. He said this on CNN earlier this year: "I can no longer call myself a fellow Republican. You know, not a fellow of anything right now. I'm just a citizen." As a citizen, I played that clip from January 7th because he was a very concerned citizen, calling it a national disgrace. Was he optimistic that the party that had been infected by disinformation and inspired to do that would purge itself of that, or did he remain concerned?
I just think it was part of his nature, and actually part of the nature of a lot of strong and effective American leaders. And he often said that optimism is a force multiplier. And I think he sincerely believed that. I mean, if your leader's not optimistic and he walks in there with a grim face and says, "Geez, I don't know if we can do this, guys." Well, what kind of leader is that? Colin didn't believe in approaching things that way. He came in, he said, "We've been given a hard job to do. We're going to give it our best. And damn it all, we're going to do our best to get it done." And more often than not, he got the job done.
And you served at the United Nations. You have a sense of how he was respected and revered around the world. Just talk about his impact as an ambassador for this country around the world.
Well, he was extraordinarily popular. He had a great relationship. He came up to the UN every year while he was secretary, and he had meetings with all the different government leaders, presidents, and foreign ministers. They all wanted to meet him. They all loved him dearly. He really was had a very, very friendly style, and he got along very well with the people, most of the foreign ministers who were on the Security Council at the time, whether it was Jack Straw. Even Sergei Lavrov, I think, had the Russian foreign minister, then the representative there, had a good relationship with General Powell. He had perhaps a bit of a falling out with the French foreign minister, Dominique Villepin, because of the fight over the second resolution, which proposed that we seek the authorization for the use of force from the Security Council, which we ultimately did not get.
Right. How did that he's written about it. I mean, his Pottery Barn rule became household sort of lexicon for part of how that went wrong right out of the gates. But how did his role in sort of selling the Iraq war change how he would view the country after his years of service in the Bush years?
Well, if you're referring to the way we presented the question of weapons of mass destruction and whether Iraq had them, I was with him the night before the presentation, and he went over it again for the umpteenth time. He spent a whole week going out to the CIA practically every day trying to scrub the information down. He rehearsed it again. George Tenet was there. He said he wanted to be sure that that this was all right. We weeded out some more material. So, I mean, he was very cautious, and he made the presentation in good faith. But it later on turned out that even that information, the scrubbed down version of the briefing, turned out not to be true. And I think that was probably one of the deepest, if not the deepest, disappointments of his diplomatic career. And as he himself said, you know, they're gonna write about that in my obituary. And he was very, very upset about that. And he felt that he'd been really let down by the intelligence community.
Ambassador John Negroponte, you're by his side for some real historical moments and periods in this country's history. I'm really grateful to you for taking some time to talk to us about your friend and former colleague, and I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to bring into our conversation MSNBC medical contributor, Dr. Uche Blackstock. She's a founder and CEO of Advancing Health Equity. So General Colin Powell died of complications from COVID. Just talk about how that could be. He was vaccinated. He had a lot of complicating health conditions. Just give us some information, some facts, some context.
Sure. Nicole, thank you so much for having me. You know, I think the tragic take-home message from Colin Powell's death is that vaccines, while they are incredibly effective, our most vulnerable community members are still at high risk. So Colin Powell had multiple myeloma. It's a blood cancer that affects immune cells. So he had a weakened immune system. Combine that with the fact that he was of advanced age, that made him incredibly high risk. So he developed severe COVID-19 and died as a result. And so what's important is that what it shows is that if the viral transmission levels in the community are still high, if people have not been vaccinated, if people are not masking, physical distancing, our community members who are immunocompromised and elderly are still at very high risk.
I want to read some of the New York Times reporting on what you're sort of shedding light on. People with multiple myeloma have compromised immune systems and are thus at greater risk of developing severe COVID. Vaccines are also likely to be less effective in these patients. In a study published in July, researchers found that just 45% of those with active multiple myeloma developed an adequate response after receiving either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines. So just help us understand that. Does that mean that less than half of the people with multiple myeloma who are vaccinated become immune from COVID from the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines?
Right, Nicole. As a result of the process, the disease process, they do not respond to vaccines the same way as someone with a healthy immune system. And so that's one of the reasons why boosters were approved in immunocompromised people first, because of data like this showing that their immune systems don't respond as robustly as someone with a healthy immune system. And so that's why everyone needs to do their part. You know, Colin Powell did his part. He got fully vaccinated, but there probably were others around him that were not fully vaccinated, and that put him at risk.
Oh, Dr. Uche Blackstock, I wish it were a better occasion, but it is wonderful to get to talk to you about all this. Thank you so much for being part of our coverage. When we come back, President Biden saying he hopes the January 6th committee goes after the witnesses who attempt to defy its subpoenas. A vote against Steve Bannon set for tomorrow. The very latest on that impending deadline is next for us. Plus, united in the belief that the election was stolen, united again in what the New York Times describes as a breathtaking act of physical brutality on January 6th. New reporting on how seven never before connected individuals came together over 90 seconds to carry out acts of violence against Capitol Police officers. And later in the program, a moment of truth this week for the United States Senate when it comes to preserving our democracy. Majority Leader Schumer calling for one last showdown on the Freedom to Vote Act. All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
What's your message to people who defy congressional subpoenas on the January 6th committee?
I hope that the committee goes after them and holds them accountable.
Should they be prosecuted by the Justice Department?
I do, yes.
President Biden there urging accountability for the Trump aides and allies who were defying a subpoena for depositions and document production from the January 6th Select Committee. A vote by the committee tomorrow to hold Steve Bannon in contempt of Congress will set in motion a process that could lead to criminal prosecutions for the people trying to stonewall the investigation into the Capitol insurrection. In response to the president, a DOJ spokesperson said, quote, the Department of Justice will make its own independent decisions in all prosecutions based solely on the facts and the law. Period. Full stop. But President Biden's comments earned the support of a key member of the January 6th committee, Republican Adam Kinzinger. Watch.
I think the president has every right to signal. I think he has every right to make it clear where the administration stands. I mean, God knows the prior administration every, 2 hours was trying to signal to the Justice Department. But, you know, that had to do with other pretty horrific things. And I think the president has made it clear that we need answers to this. And I think, the vast majority of Americans agree. So this potential criminal contempt referral, or will be criminal contempt referral for Steve Bannon, is the first shot over the bow. It's very real. But it says to anybody else coming in front of the committee, don't think that you're going to be able to just kind of walk away and we're going to forget about you. We're not.
Joining us now, Jackie Alemany, Washington Post congressional correspondent and author of the Early 202 newsletter, and Clint Watts, former consultant to the FBI counterterrorism division, now an MSNBC national security analyst. Jackie, tell me where this stands on the eve of the committee vote on a contempt citation.
Yeah, Nicole, thanks so much for having me. Where this stands is the House is very likely, at least the Select Committee is very likely to hold Steve Bannon in criminal contempt tomorrow. They're holding a vote at 7:30. All lawmakers that we've spoken with in the weeks leading up to tomorrow have indicated that they're ready to move as expeditiously and aggressively as possible in getting people to comply with their subpoenas. Steve Bannon has been the one person who has declined to engage with the committee. After that, the matter is then going to be voted on by the House. It's likely to be passed since Democrats hold a slim majority. Then the matter will be referred to the U.S. Attorney's Office for Washington, D.C. for criminal prosecution. Criminal contempt, it could end up with Steve Bannon having to pay a fine of potentially $100,000 or even ending up a year behind bars. So this is a momentous week. Usually Congress moves to hold people in civil contempt. That's what we saw under the Trump administration. But it is a slow process. That's why you're seeing the January 6th Select Committee move quickly with criminal contempt.
I want to show you, Clint Watts, how Adam Schiff is framing the stakes for the Department of Justice, no less than a question about whether or not the rule of law matters. Listen, this is him with Kara Swisher.
Witnesses who fail to show up now will need to contemplate they may very well be prosecuted.
Will they?
Well, we will find out.
Who? How?
If witnesses fail to show up, then the committee can make criminal referrals to the Department of Justice. We can hold them in criminal contempt and seek prosecution by the Justice Department. And it will be the decision of the Justice Department. Now, I have to hope and pray that we will not have another 4 years where people can flout the rule of law and get away with it.
Clint, Adam Schiff making clear this is about more than a congressional committee. This is about answering a question, whether or not the rule of law can snap back after 4 years under Donald Trump and Bill Barr.
That's right, Nicole. And they absolutely, I think, need to pursue prosecution, because if they don't, it literally would give precedence for everyone, regardless of any committee, to just not respond, you know, when brought up with any sort of a subpoena or a call to Congress in general. Imagine all the committee hearings across the board. Anytime someone doesn't want to show up, we've been talking about social media, for example, they don't want to show up or they don't want to return records, then now they have a precedent that they could do that. I think it's interesting as well, though, and it seems to be the sense, is that this is the showdown that Bannon wants. He wants to put that challenge up there. And remember, I think for him and many of his group, their time is waning. And so this is a way to continue to stir up trouble, continue to be in the news, and continue this sort of standoff. Remember, Steve Bannon's principal focus has always been death of the administrative state. You would hear him talk about that during the early years of the Trump administration. Well, he would be killing off the administrative state if he were not prosecuted in this. It's actually a challenge. It's at the core of what our country is about. Can he alone sort of make this challenge? And will there be any follow-up to it in the future?
And Jackie, I know you have some new reporting about the committee laying waste to Bannon's phony claim of executive privilege. Talk about that.
Yeah, Nicole, we talked to a number of GOP lawyers actually to get their take on these letters that we obtained between Steve Bannon's lawyer and the January 6th Select Committee, who also say that Bannon has a very weak legal argument. These are people like Jonathan Turley, who said as much. This is the guy who defended President Trump during the impeachment hearings in 2019. Or 2020, during one of the impeachment hearings,
and
came to his
straight.
Defense repeatedly. but basically, in Benny Thompson, the chairman of the January 6th committee's legal arguments, he said that, number one, the former president, President Trump, hasn't even communicated or tried to exert executive privilege to the January 6th Select Committee. So therefore, Bannon is not protected by that. They're still waiting to hear from the former president. And then secondly, Steve Bannon does not enjoy the privileges that some of Trump's senior advisors or people who served in the White House during this period of time, during January 6th, the privileges that they enjoy. Further, the committee is asking for communications between Bannon and lawmakers and protest organizers, which are also not protected by executive privilege. Those are just Steve Bannon's personal communications as a private citizen. He has the most tangential claim to being protected by executive privilege. So you're going to see this committee try to poke holes in his legal argument. And I think it's going to be supported by legal excerpts across the board.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a good sign, Clint Watts, that Donald Trump doesn't really have a claim to executive privilege as an ex-president. Let me show you Adam Kinzinger talking about potentially subpoenaing Donald Trump down the road so as not to turn this into a circus just yet. Watch.
I think, you know, just speaking quite honestly, if we subpoena all of a sudden the former president, we know that's going to become kind of a circus. So that's not necessarily something we want to do up front. But if he has pieces of information we need, we certainly will. This is not, Jake, here's the thing. This isn't about necessarily even getting answers for tomorrow and hoping that, you know, the people that believe the insurrection was really some Antifa, you know, false flag thing are going to believe it. When I think about what we're doing on the committee, I think in terms of, yes, I hope we can change minds tomorrow, you know, after we get the report, basically sometime in the future. But this is about the 10-year argument. You know, what are our kids going to think when they read the history books? Who's going to win that argument? And I've always believed since I've been a kid in Sunday school that truth needs to win out.
A 10-year war to get the truth out. That is, in some ways, a far more lethal threat to Donald Trump and his ilk than sort of surviving any news cycle with their Fox-fueled disinfo.
That's right, Nicole. And most of the arguments that you hear from the president, former President Trump, and his supporters don't pass the civics test. These are people that clearly have never really explored the articles that they say that they are fighting for. And I think that's part of the challenge that you'll see over time is how much enthusiasm can there really be for a former president who continues to recite these lies. I think it becomes boredom for many of his supporters. I think the main thing for us, you know, thinking about our country and our democracy is the truth does have to win out. And far too often, I think over the last 5 years, we've thought that, hey, we will speak the truth once, we'll send an official out with some official documents and truth will win. It's really not how it works in the information space anymore. You have to pursue this day in and day out, and we can never stop advancing the truth, because that's ultimately the bedrock of our democracy.
We will never stop. Jackie Alameh, thank you for joining us with your new reporting. Clint is sticking around. There's incredible new reporting on the attack at the Capitol, peeling back some of what we think we know about the insurrectionists who were led there, fed the big lie, and spurred on by their leaders. One of the reporters on this must-read new piece from the weekend joins us next.
You all have seen the president for many years on the news almost every night for 5-6 years now. So the president was exactly as you would expect him to be. He answered questions the way that you would expect Mr. Trump to answer questions, and conducted himself in a manner that you would expect Mr. Trump to conduct himself.
That doesn't tell us too much. That was the lawyer for the plaintiffs in the lawsuit against the twice impeached ex-president who, for the very first time since being elected president in 2016, was deposed today on camera over at Trump Tower after being ordered by a court to answer questions under oath in regards to the suit, which was filed by several protesters who alleged that they were roughed up by Trump security detail following a protest outside his Manhattan building in 2015, where the demonstrators were protesting his immigration stances. His 4.5 hours under oath today could be testimony that could be used in trial if the case goes to trial. Joining us now, NBC News investigations correspondent Tom Winter and former Deputy Assistant Attorney General and former U.S. Attorney Harry Lipman. Tom Winter, you first. Tell us about this case. Will it go to trial?
Well, that's going to be a big question going forward, and I bet some of that depends on what actually happened at Trump Tower today and that nearly 4.5 hours worth of testimony that you just referenced, Nicole. I think when you look at this case, there is video of this alleged assault that occurred. There are images of this alleged assault that occurred. That was an important day in the Trump candidacy. It may feel like 2 weeks ago or 20 years ago, but it was just a little over 7 years ago that Trump pledged his allegiance to the GOP and said he would not run as a third-party candidate, September 3rd, 2015. And that's when this protest and alleged assault took place. There are allegations that a protester was hit in the head, was punched by Keith Schiller, Trump's former personal bodyguard and right-hand man, that their protest signs were destroyed, and that another protester was nearly choked. So significant allegations of assault. And what we'll have to see going forward, Nicole, I think, as we watch this case, is whether or not there's any talks of a settlement, and whether or not the attorneys for the people that have alleged these assaults are able to prove that Trump knew that these bodyguards were under his direction, and that according to law, and there's a theory in law, and Harry is probably much better equipped to talk about this, but a theory of law that essentially if somebody commits an act, an intentional act that they were authorized to do on your behalf as an employer, that you may be personally liable. So I think that's going to be another key turning point in this case.
I wonder, Harry, this is something I've asked you about. I want to show you now. Trump did advocate violence. Let me show you from our friends at Rachel Maddow.
If you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously. Okay? Just knock the hell. I promise you, I will pay for the legal fees. I promise.
I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks.
Get out of here. Get out. Oh, this is amazing.
So much fun. I love it. I love it. We having a good time. USA, USA. All right, yeah, get him out. Try not to hurt him. If you do, I'll defend you in court. Don't worry about it.
Harry Trump calling for violence against protesters, promising to pay the bills if anyone gets sued for carrying out violence against protesters, and Trump romanticizing an era where violence against protesters that's so severe you're carried out on a stretcher is the norm.
Sure sounds like the portrait of someone who's authorized his bodyguards to use violence. That's what the plaintiffs say, and very significantly, Keith Schiller, the actual goon who we have on videotape, said that he was authorized to use violence. Very significantly, Nicole, the judge let those snippets be played today. So the defense attorney told us he was able to question Trump on these campaign rally statements. I think a lot of judges wouldn't have permitted it, would have said it's too far afield. This judge did. And going to what Tom said, I do think it makes settlement more likely because we are now, everybody, going to see this deposition. It's designed to be played at trial if there's a trial. And the only way to keep it from now being made public is if he settles the case at a pretty penny, I would think, because the plaintiffs now know they have some sort of leverage over him.
We will watch this space with your help. NBC's Tom Winter and Harry Lipman, thank you both so much for spending some time with us on it. The next hour of Deadline White House starts after a quick break. Don't go anywhere. We're just getting started. There's a stunning new piece of reporting in the New York Times from the weekend that pulls the curtain back even further on the brutal violence from the January 6th insurrection, focusing on seven men from very different walks of life who are now forever bound together in a series of alleged crimes they committed on January 6th at the insurrection, including the violent assault of police officers. New York Times combed through reams of video footage to identify the seven. We're going to warn you, the video is graphic. We're going to show you a short portion. Watch.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Now, because of the strong language, we could only show a short clip, but it does show the seven defendants there within feet of one another, trying to storm the Capitol and attacking police officers standing in their way. The video now stands as one of countless pieces of crucial evidence in what the Times is describing as a, quote, reckoning, as prosecutors and congressional investigators seek to understand how a political rally devolved into an assault on the citadel of American democracy and those who guard it. They're drilling down on whether the riot was organized and what roles were played by far-right extremist groups, various Trump supporters, and Trump himself. Joining us now, one of the Times reporters whose byline is on that piece, Matthew Rosenberg, and Clint Watts is still here. Matthew, so it's an incredible piece of reporting. In the whole 90 seconds, I encourage everyone to go into the story and watch the whole thing. It's embedded. It took us a long time to get all the F-bombs out, which is why we showed such a short snippet there. But I want to put up for our viewers the seven, or the folks who are now bound, the seven men. To a man, they're described in superlatives by relatives and friends, perfect neighbor, devout churchgoer, attentive father, good guy. They include one, the bearded truck driver from Arkansas who weaponized Old Glory. Two, a heavy machine operator from Michigan who once modeled for the covers of romance novels. Three, a fencing contractor from Georgia. Four, a geophysicist from Colorado. Five, a former Marine from Pennsylvania. Six, a deputy sheriff from Tennessee. 7. And a self-made businessman from Kentucky named Clayton Ray Mullins, 52, described as a well-intentioned person devoted to keeping his small country church afloat. He does not drink, smoke, curse, or bother with social media. Now they're all insurrectionists facing criminal charges. Explain.
You know, every single one of these had, in their own way, bought into the idea the election was stolen. Although some said after the fact, well, we're not sure, we don't know. They showed up on January 6th to support the president. And for reasons that each one seems to have different reasons, ended up at the Capitol. Some of them were still unclear on, but they ended up for, you know, a brief moment at the Capitol on the West Steps, assaulting three police officers, brutally beating them. And then went their own ways. None of these guys knew each other. And I think one of the big takeaways from this story, and that I hope readers take away, is look, some of the most violent people that day were the most ordinary. You know, these guys were not hardcore militia members. They were not members of the white supremacy organization. They had not known each other and coordinated things. In fact, none of them seemed to have planned much except for going on that day. And now, you know, they took part in some of the most brutal violence that happened outside on the steps of the Capitol.
Yeah, I mean, Matthew, I guess for me, in some ways, it's worse, right? These were people who, until that day, hadn't engaged in hand-to-hand medieval combat with law enforcement officials. What is the tipping point for each of them?
You know, that's hard to say. They come from a fairly diverse set of backgrounds. There is the cross trainer from Georgia. I went to his hometown. You know, I went to houses of friends of his. And there I got a lot of what one would expect in that situation. People telling me to get off their property, people calling me up and threatening to beat me up. But then there's the truck driver from Arkansas. I went to his hometown. He lives on a block that is incredibly diverse. His neighbors, three immediate neighbors, are all Black. Two of them called him the best neighbor they ever had. One of them is his closest friend. And they said he was a real talker, but never talked about politics. So what brings people, what kind of takes them to the tipping point is I think hard to discern any kind of meaningful group way. But I think, you know, one thing we know here is that, look, ordinary people were mobilized. If this were simply a militia issue, I think there would be a way to handle that. This isn't. There are tens of millions of Americans who share the views that propel this fight at the Capitol. These are 7 who acted on it in a particularly violent way. But there, I think the challenge ahead of us is how do we manage that? These are our fellow citizens. They are people who live next door to us. How do we manage that, and how do we bring them to a point where there isn't violence and one can have a conversation?
Clint Watts, you're one of the people who in the past has had to solve this. I think Matthew's using the word mobilize. I might say radicalized. How do you have conversations with Americans who've been radicalized?
This is one of the strangest things, Nicole, is that many of the patterns that we would see and we would talk about in the 2000s around Al-Qaeda or ISIS recruits are very similar to this. There was never one profile of a terrorist or an extremist out there. And so when you looked at it, it was always confusing how people could get swept up into something that they ultimately came to regret or didn't entirely understand. And that's what we see here with January 6th. I think there's one part of this equation that we sometimes overlook, which is isolation. A key part of much of what we saw during the extremist years internationally were young men, older men that were isolated and wanted to be part of a cause and part of a calling. And they were oftentimes wrapped up or swept up in the emotions and the madness of a mob. And I think we see that today. It's important to note, though, that there was some organization and there were some groups that showed up there. And they were some of the most vicious when it came to organizing that day and really leading things. So I think this is where you get that dangerous combination of people that are swept up in a moment, maybe don't understand all of the forces that are going on behind the scenes, but when pointed in the right direction by a demagogue or an ideologue, when pointed to the right place at the right time where you do have more organized and violent elements, it can tip off this cascade of violence that we saw on January 6th. I bet there are many that are out there and you know, are very remorseful of it, but it's really how do we reach out to them and bring them back so that we can create peace in this country?
Matthew Rosenberg, it's an incredible piece of reporting and incredibly presented. Anyone who hasn't seen it, I encourage them to go look at it. And Clint Watts, thank you for being part of our conversation and our coverage. Thank you both. Donald Trump today was under oath for more than 4 hours. It's a lawsuit that alleges violence by his security team. The videotape deposition several years in the making is our next story.
kind of Congress would we be if we did not respond to all of these voter suppression bills that are mushrooming all over the country? A violent insurrection on this very Capitol, driven by the big lie, metastasized into a kind of voter suppression cancer all across the body politic. I want to remind all of us that the only reason we're here in this chamber at all is because somebody voted for us. Voting rights is not just some other issue alongside other issues. It gets to the heart of who we are in the first place, a democracy. The most powerful words ever uttered in a democracy are "the people have spoken." Shame on us if we allow the people's voices to be silenced in this chamber.
Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York. The time has come, and it's all on the Democrats, unfortunately. They're all we have left. They have to make the ultimate choice, democracy or the filibuster. That's it. Nothing else on the menu. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer moving today to set up a vote in the Senate on the Freedom to Vote Act, likely to take place Wednesday. Schumer has made clear the legislation has the full support of all 50 Democrats, puts it in a better position than the previous voting rights bill, the For the People Act, but it still falls well short of the 60 votes it needs to pass with the filibuster in place. Sets up this week's possible last dance for voting rights legislation, as our colleague NBC's Sahil Kapoor puts it. Senate Democrats will have to go on the record with how much they're committed to preserving and protecting the integrity of our democracy, the right to vote, or whether they think it's more important to leave a Senate procedural thing in place, the filibuster. As of right now, two Democratic senators, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, do not support eliminating the filibuster in any circumstance, which, as we just said, is the Freedom to Vote Act's only path for survival. Voting rights advocates stress that President Biden's engagement and messaging is key to getting the bill passed. So far, they're not impressed. Washington Post reports this, quote, voting rights advocates meet once every week or two with White House officials via video conference. In almost every session, an advocate speaks up to say that President Biden must do more, that American democracy is under threat, and the president is not meeting the challenge. At one such meeting earlier this year, a Biden aide responded that Democrats would simply have to, quote, out-organize the other side. It's according to multiple advocates familiar with the exchange who spoke anonymously. The comment infuriated advocates who believe they're watching former President Trump actively and perhaps permanently undermine faith in U.S. elections. That is exactly what is happening. The ex-president is doing it out loud. He has said so. He's made abundantly clear that the only litmus test for being a Republican now is to embrace the big lie about fraud. Former presidents are already laying the groundwork, laying the foundation for the next election fight, guaranteeing that if he runs again and contests the election results again, he's going to be in a great position, a far more advantageous spot than he was in 2020. NBC News reports this, quote, in next year's races for governor and secretary of state, for Congress, and all the way down to state legislative seats, Republicans eager for Trump support have embraced these baseless claims about a stolen election. The issue is particularly animating campaigns for Secretary of State, the office that in many states oversees elections, in electoral battlegrounds that narrowly backed Biden over Trump in 2020 and will be hotly contested again in the 2024 presidential election. Democrats' moment of truth when it comes to saving our democracy from Trump Republicans is where we start this hour with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Jake Sherman is here, founder of Punchbowl News and an MSNBC contributor. Also with us, Jason Johnson, journalism and politics professor at Morgan State University, MSNBC, and the Griot contributor. And Congressman Joe Neguse is here of Colorado. He's a member of the House Judiciary Committee, as well as a House impeachment manager during Trump's second impeachment trial. Congressman, I'm not an expert on very many things anymore in American politics, but I promise you this. Donald Trump can lose again, but you have no guarantee that the winner will become the next president if nothing happens at the federal level. Do people understand that?
Certainly the House Democratic Caucus understands it, Nicole, and it's good to be with you. I think you articulated it well. Really, the question facing the Senate is a binary question, whether they will save democracy or not. I am hopeful that after tomorrow, or I suppose Wednesday's vote, cloture vote on the compromise measure that you described and that Senator Manchin has put forward, that perhaps those two Democratic senators that you referenced will have the clarity that they have apparently or ostensibly been looking for, and that we can finally get to the business of doing what has to be done, which is ultimately performing a constitutional carve out of the filibuster, as Whip Clyburn has recommended, so that we can protect voting rights, which are, as Senator Warnock so eloquently put it on the Senate floor, sacrosanct, you know, the most fundamental right under our Constitution, the right from which all other rights flow.
Has Joe Biden done enough?
Look, I think that President Biden has, my sense, has tried to give the senators who have been negotiating this compromise measure for the better part of the last several months the sufficient time and space to do that. I suspect that you will see the president perhaps engage in more robust outreach in the coming weeks following Wednesday's vote. I think that that is likely to be the case. He has been unabashed about his position on this particular issue. I think he has issued a clarion call to his colleagues in Congress to take this seriously. And so I expect that he will do even more than he has done already.
The president gave an extremely powerful speech in Philadelphia, well-received, and has done nothing else publicly. Congressman, is there more happening that we don't see? Is his involvement greater than that?
Certainly, the White House has had a number of conversations with members. I won't get into those private conversations. Suffice to say, I think the president has made very clear his belief that Republicans in various state legislatures across the country are really crossing red lines in terms of implementing very subversive pieces of legislation that undermine the fundamental right to vote. And he has been very clear in his support for the legislative efforts that we have been pushing in the United States Congress to attempt to push back and roll back those state efforts. So I suspect that you'll see more from the president in the coming days and weeks ahead after the vote on Wednesday.
Are you optimistic?
I'm certainly not optimistic about the vote on Wednesday. I think the cloture vote is likely to fail. I suppose we'll see what Jake has to say, if he has any insights in terms of his conversations on Capitol Hill. But I don't think that there is any likelihood that the filibuster will be overcome with respect to the compromise measure. I am optimistic that at the end of the day, we will be able to reach an accommodation with respect to reform of the filibuster that enables us to get to the president's desk voting rights legislation. And that optimism is largely born from, I think, the reality that public opinion has changed so dramatically over the course of the last 9 months on this particular issue, largely because of the efforts that I described in states like Texas and Florida, Georgia and Iowa, where I think it is becoming all too clear to the vast majority of Americans that you have many in the other political party who are working to try to undermine the right to vote of each and every American, regardless of one's political affiliation. And that's simply antithetical to what we believe fundamentally as Americans.
And Jake, look, how bad are the voter suppression laws? Well, they're so bad that Major League Baseball moved the All-Star game out of Georgia at the beginning of this conversation. In some ways, it's remarkable that Major League Baseball did more than just about anyone else to protest voter suppression laws. But that's where we were. Where are we now, Jake?
Well, let me just respond to a couple things that the congressman said. I have a lot of respect for him, but I just think that we get into this, we as a political, people who follow politics and cover politics, we get into these discussions about Joe Manchin and hope that he, again, not me, but hope, I think Democrats hope that he is somebody he is not. Joe Manchin is a supporter of the filibuster. He is for a 60-vote threshold for legislation. Joe Biden has not said one word about eliminating the filibuster, nor, and if he said something, Joe Manchin's not moving. Like, people look for this deeper meaning in what Joe Manchin, and we see this all the time in the mainstream media, I guess, of which I'm a part, but I'd like to think we're not guilty of this, but like, Joe Manchin is a supporter of the filibuster. He has said a million times he's not changing the filibuster, he's not changing the 60-vote threshold. This legislation is going nowhere. I don't know if there's a better way to understand this, but Joe Manchin is supporting the filibuster. And I just think that people, you know, I understand the importance or what Democrats consider the importance of this legislation. I get all of that. But Manchin just is not moved. And we see this, by the way, not only on this, Nicole, but on the reconciliation package. I know that's not the topic here, but just to like tie this together, this is an unfortunate habit that we've gotten into. Joe Manchin is for a $1.5 trillion bill, is not for clean energy provisions, and he's not changing. And people might not like it or might decide to ignore it or might hope that he's become a different politician than he is, but Joe Manchin is much closer to Republicans on all of these issues, and he's not going to change, and we should take him at his word when he says what he's for and what he's against.
So, Jason, I appreciate the reality check from Jake Sherman, and I'm sure he's correct. He usually is. So let's take his reporting to the bank. There will be no federal legislation to protect the right to vote in America. Right now, I think there are 407 voter suppression, voter nullification laws racing through. 33 of them have become law. They're auditing the count in counties and states where Trump won. They're laying the groundwork to overturn not just the next presidential election where Trump's on the ballot, and it won't even matter if he wins or loses next time. Jason, the whole frame around which we cover politics will not matter. It will not matter if Joe Biden wins Georgia and Arizona again, because you could have insurrections popping up all over. Where are we heading?
So this is weird. I am not an optimist when it comes to any of this, but I have always believed, and I have said this for a long time about Joe Manchin, as much as I have disagreed with tons of his positions, is that he has always left himself wiggle room if he chooses for a big John McCain moment where he'll make sure he goes down in the history books. To say that you don't want to weaken the filibuster, to say that you don't want to destroy the filibuster, is not the same thing as saying that you wouldn't be willing to make a change. I think there is a possibility, I'm not saying likely, but there is a possibility that Joe Manchin could agree with President Biden and say, I don't want to destroy the filibuster, but I do think we have to go back to a filibuster where you had to stand there and actually argue your point instead of it just being a slip of paper. If he were to make that concession, it is possible to get this legislation passed. So that's the first thing I want to say. If that does not occur, if there is no change, if there is no federal voting legislation, then we're essentially a banana republic. I mean, it's all over after that. We don't even have to get to 2024. I've said all along, if Republicans take over the House and Senate in 2022, they'll find some excuse to impeach Joe Biden. And the only concern that I've had about this all along, whether it's Manchin or Sinema or President Biden or anything else like that, is I don't understand. This is a violation of all common sense political science. The number one job of a politician is to make sure you get reelected. And if Democrats don't do this, they're all going to lose their job. So I don't understand how they can have apprehension. We will be a one-party state if none of this gets done. But I hold out the possibility that Joe Manchin has left himself wiggle room so that he can look like the hero that saved democracy and still continue to be an obstructionist down the road.
Go ahead, Jake.
Yeah, no, Manchin has said those things. He has said, I will not change the filibuster. Stop asking me about that. And he's not supported a carve out for this. He's not supported that. And he said he has entertained conversations about the talking filibuster. But he has said in order to end the talking filibuster, you need 60 votes. So, yes, it would make it more difficult to filibuster. By the way, he's not said he's for this. He has said he is willing to consider it.
Yeah.
And just let me just add one more thing here. What Manchin has, what supporters of the filibuster have said is that there is no such thing as a carve out, right? They find it very difficult within the Senate's rules and the Senate's strictures and traditions to carve out and say there's only one thing that you need 50 votes on. I was literally, Nicole, just having this conversation with some other reporters in the hallway by the Senate chamber. If there was ever an opportunity to blow up the filibuster, it would be like today if the debt ceiling wasn't lifted. I could see like a cataclysmic event like that for the economy. You could see something like that happening. But I think before that, Republicans would drop in and vote for it like Mitch McConnell did a couple weeks ago. So like Manchin has basically said all the things that we're saying here, which is I'm not for it. I'm not leaving I'm like, stop asking me about it. I'm done talking about it. That's what he said. I mean, I there is very little wiggle room here and very little daylight that I see unless I'm missing something.
Jake, I guess the thing is Mitch McConnell did put the filibuster aside for judges. So I think maybe Jason holds out that the future and fate of our democracy, the ability not just to have the right to vote, but to have your vote not nullified by the Frankenstein post-Raffensperger Secretary of State that Trump backs in Georgia, for one example, there are dozens, might be as urgent as a judge. No.
Totally, Nicole. I see that. All I'm saying is that at this moment, we have no available evidence that that's the case. Like, maybe that does happen. Maybe they rewrite the rules of the Senate or they change the filibuster. I'm completely leaving open the fact that that could happen at some point in time. But right now, based on the information that we know and the reporting that we have, that we get every day up here, there is no openness to changing the filibuster among with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. And by the way, there are, in my estimation, other people who have privately suggested the same thing and are also wary about it, that don't get as much attention. But Manchin at the moment is catching all the flack, so to speak, on that front.
Congressman, I want to bring you back in on this. Caught my attention. This is from Derek Johnson, president of the NAACP. So the administration's lack of urgency about safeguarding democracy, especially by shoring up voting rights, is, quote, appalling. I've heard from many of my colleagues and members that the lack of priority around voting rights will be the undoing of the legacy for this presidency. Not just its legacy. It seems like it could undo. I mean, President Biden's primary candidacy was resurrected for one reason. Black voters, male, female, young and old in South Carolina, bet on him big. That's it. That you could write a book. Maybe you could sell a book. It could be long, but you only need one chapter. That is how Joe Biden became the president. That was the single event that turned around an ailing primary candidacy. And this is the assessment from the NAACP that their efforts are, quote, appalling. Do you agree with that?
Well, look, I would say, Nicole, obviously I share the concerns and I think the passions of many who would like to see the Congress pass a voting rights bill and send it to the president's desk for his signature. And I think the president agrees with that principle. And he's been very unabashed and very public in his pronouncements on that topic. That being said, as we've just talked at great length about, clearly there are two Democratic United States senators who have a differing worldview on this particular issue. And so I think the president is doing everything that he can and using every tool in his toolbox and at his disposal to make the case to those senators to ultimately join the rest of the Democratic caucus in the Senate and the House in getting this bill to his desk. Now, I have a more optimistic view of this than Jake does, Nicole, I must tell you. Look, I get it. I understand why some believe that the calcification of these views by Senator Manchin, for example, are unlikely to change. I don't doubt the sincerity of his views, but there used to be, as you said, a filibuster for judicial nominees. There was once a filibuster for executive branch nominees. The reconciliation budget process is, in effect, an exception to the filibuster. So this notion that somehow this cannot be done and that a constitutional carve-out is not possible, I just don't buy that. I think that at the end of the day, Senator Manchin has put a lot of time and effort into crafting the compromise measure that he has put forward. And we're going to have a good opportunity on Wednesday to see an up or down, or hopefully get to an up or down vote on that particular bill. And assuming that that vote does not go the way that we would like, hopefully that will provide the clarity that Senator Manchin has been looking for and others, perhaps, so that we can have a real conversation about a constitutional carve out. But we should not assume that the Senate is impervious to public opinion. And for those who would make that argument, I'd point them back to the American Rescue Plan. There were many who doubted the president's ability to get a $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan through the Congress back in March. Many senators expressed their opposition to components of that bill before it ultimately earned the support of every single Senate Democrat and the vast majority of House Democrats. So I think time will tell, but I am confident that we're going to keep working on this and treating it with the seriousness that it deserves.
I will never shout down optimism. I appreciate yours, Congressman Jake Sherman, as much as I appreciate your reporting. Thank you both for starting us off this hour. Jason's sticking around. And let the record reflect Jason was optimistic today, too. Coming up for us, Donald Trump slammed over the weekend by a senator from his own party who thinks Donald Trump's conduct on the campaign trail could be the GOP's undoing in 2022 and 2024. Ha! You don't say. Plus, a brand new legal development in the standoff between the ex-president and the January 6th committee. And coming up next, Colin Powell, remembered today for his four decades in public service, the first Black National Security Advisor, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and Secretary of State. But one veteran remembers him mostly from a chance encounter on the side of a road. We'll show you that. Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Today, the nation mourns the death of former Secretary of State Colin Powell, remembering his decades of service to our country. Earlier, our friend and colleague Andrea Mitchell shared memories of Secretary Powell's compassion. And this one time in 2019, when he and a fellow veteran who had lost a leg while serving in Afghanistan met on the side of the road when Secretary Powell was stranded with a flat tire.
When I walked up to him, I said, "You're General Colin Powell." And he said, "Yes, I am."
He jumped out of his car, his sleeveless shirt on, short pants, and said, "Why is this guy freezing to death?" He just wanted to help me.
It was almost felt like meeting an old friend. And so you're just two people on the side of the road, and you have a situation, you have a flat tire, and you're going to fix the flat.
There was a connection between the two of you.
Yeah, because once I saw the leg, I wasn't sure whether it was blown off or he had an infection, and it turned out it was a combination of two. And so I knew he was one of me. He was one of my guys.
He was one of my guys. Powell later posted about the incident online, writing this, quote, "You touched my soul and reminded me about what this country is all about and why it is so great. Let's stop screaming at each other. Let's just take care of each other." Joining us now is Corey Shockey, senior fellow and director of foreign and defense policy at the American Enterprise Institute. She worked in the office of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Colin Powell. Also joining us, NBC News chief foreign affairs correspondent Andrea Mitchell. Andrea, I have watched the coverage all day long, and nothing gets me every single time like your interview and your storytelling about this incident on the side of the road. For all of his military and political accomplishments, it is this story that just gets me. Tell me about it.
Well, as he would say in the Yiddish that he sometimes spoke from the grocery store he worked in the neighborhood in the Bronx, he was a mensch, a great human being. And I think Corey would agree, for all of his military prowess and his wisdom and his judgment, he was such a good soul. There is so much to this. But I also wanted to say to all of you people on social media who say, oh, you see, the vaccines don't work, because he and his wife were fully vaccinated. Colin Powell was an 84-year-old man with serious underlying conditions. He had had prostate cancer. He had multiple myeloma. And what is not well known is that he also had Parkinson's in later years. So he and his wife had both been fully vaccinated. Alma Powell is going to be 84, October 27th. They are in that age bracket. He is a man and more vulnerable. And Nicole, what I can also report now is that he wasn't feeling well. They both were tested a week ago Monday, October 11th, and they tested positive. Because he wasn't feeling well, he had planned and scheduled a booster shot last week, but he already wasn't feeling well, and then they tested positive. So instead, they went to Walter Reed. She was symptomatic, but not seriously ill, and is recovering very well at home. But he was not well, and he was hospitalized and given a number of treatments. And obviously, sadly, he did not survive it. And it's just another terrible blow from this horrible pandemic. But the fact of his life, as Corey knows better than I from having worked with him in the Joint Chiefs, is that this was an extraordinary man, and a man who was at one point during Desert Storm the most popular person practically in America in yes. politics, pressed to run for president, as you know so well, and told me that he, you know, agonized over it, but then realized that was not who he was. And for personal reasons and a lot of other reasons, that was not the right role for him, and went on, you know, of course, to become Secretary of State, and had a checkered time within the very complicated National Security Council and of advisors under George Bush. Privately was against the Iraq War, and then mistakenly, to his great regret, even though he vetted all the analysis at Langley, at the CIA, the weekend before that fateful UN Security Council meeting in February of 2003. He accepted the final version from the CIA and mistakenly told the world that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, which was not true.
Corey, we've been talking about him and covering him, and this is obviously a vital part of the sort of policymaking life. I, in my time in politics, don't know that there was an endorsement in presidential history more impactful than his 2008 endorsement of President Obama. But I don't know that many people sort of knit those two things together. I played his comments on January 7th of this year. He called it a national disgrace, the insurrection of January 6th. He was one of the last moral compasses in American sort of civic life. Talk about where that came from.
It came from the authentic place of him loving this country so much, loving soldiers so much. He loved that the American military was a conveyor belt into the middle class for this country, and deeply respected the way that that shaped the American military's relationship with the broader American public. And he never lost a sense of admiration for what was possible here. I was working on the McCain campaign when then Chairman, former General Powell endorsed Barack Obama in 2008. And I remember grinding my teeth about it and having a conversation in which Powell said that Sarah Palin was going to take Republicans in a dark direction. And what were we thinking? So he always had a sense of the common good, even to hold people he admired, as he admired Senator McCain, to account for choices along the way. And he held himself accountable for those choices, too. I mean, more than anyone else who was a major figure in the run-up to the 2003 Iraq War, Secretary Powell took responsibility for his mistakes. And it's a laudable example that is sadly rare these days in American politics.
I think what you said is sort of, I think, what I was getting at in a far less eloquent way, Corey. He called out and he saw the dark forces in the Republican Party so much earlier than anybody else. He saw the Palin pick, not at a shallow level of what it sort of represented as a you know, whatever it was, a sensation. He saw the dark forces under it that lifted her up and animated it. Talk about his concerns for the country after from that moment through January 6th.
Colin Powell was an establishment Republican. He believed in guardrails, in norms, in institutional constraints. He once told me that what made him a pretty good chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was that he had spent a year working in the Office of Management and Budget. And so he knew what the military looked like to the rest of the government, which was the people who got all the money they wanted to solve their problems when nobody else did. And he thought structurally, he made every institution he was ever part of a better, stronger institution. When he was Secretary of State, he persuaded both the administration and the Congress to give money to create training programs for America's diplomats to make them better at their jobs. He cared about the people in institutions. He never thought it was odd. I went to work for him in the summer of 1990 when I was 26 years old and a civilian as his NATO expert. And that never seemed odd to him because he thought I was good at my job.
The people that knew him have so many stories like that. And on a day like today, you both knew him. And I'm really grateful to get to talk to you both. Corey Shockey, my colleague, Andrea Mitchell, thank you so much for spending some time with us. After the break, we have breaking news in the January 6th investigation. Don't go anywhere. We're following breaking news from the January 6th committee investigation. The ex-president is now suing the 1-6 committee in D.C. District Court, seeking to block any of those White House documents of his from his time as president that the committee has requested from the National Archives. National Archives also named in the ex-president's brand new lawsuit. The rather desperate attempt against the bipartisan investigators tasked with getting to the bottom of the Capitol insurrection that happened because of and under him calls the committee's subpoena invalid and argues it should be protected by executive privilege. Joining our coverage, Carol Lennick, Washington Post, national reporter and MSNBC contributor and co-author of the book, I Alone Can Fix It, and former Deputy Assistant Attorney General and former U.S. Attorney Harry Lipman is still with us. Carol, let me read from the Washington Post story that just came up. Former President Trump is suing to block the House committee investigating the January 6th attack from receiving records it's requested regarding his role and the role of his aides. Lawsuit argues that the records request is overly broad and has no legislative purpose. They go on to say, quote, the committee's request amounts to nothing less than a vexatious illegal fishing expedition openly endorsed by President Biden designed to unconstitutionally investigate Trump and his administration. Our laws do not permit such an impulsive, egregious action against a former president and his close advisors. There's sometimes some projection in the statements that come out of him, and I seized on impulsive and egregious, and I thought back to your book and the scenes of the vice president refusing to leave. How much of this is fear from the ex-president that this probe may actually be the one to turn his White House inside out?
There's no doubt, Nicole, and I like your word fear here, because there's no doubt that there's fear within the Trump camp. I can't speak for the former president, but in that camp about the fact that he's no longer at the controls. He's no longer the person who has the power to have definitively defined whether or not there's executive privilege that shields these documents from public review. And by the way, on the law, which Harry will be able to speak to much more definitively than I will, but I could just tell you from reading the actual language of the public records law, the presidential records law in this case, it's clear that the sitting president and the recently former president have a right to review and question whether or not these documents can be shared. But it's also clear under the executive order that governs this that the sitting president has the preeminence and that you're not allowed to decide how the records law applies to you. For example, in this suit, former President Trump says he wants to see all the records that are sought before he agrees whether or not they should be shared. Well, that's not what the rules are. He says he wants to challenge everything about this request, but this is a special request for Congress to be able to see these, not for public release immediately, but for Congress in its fact-finding mission to see these records. And thus far, every single part of that law has been followed. He and his lawyers have been allowed to see the records that might be released. So they already have sort of a front row seat to know what's going to be shared. As you point out, if the president, the former president, is so sure that nothing bad happened and he was not engaged in anything inappropriate, then he should be able to see from the records he personally has reviewed already whether or not there's a problem. And I don't think executive privilege is the issue.
So Harry, Carol is pointing out the most important thing of the story that I miss. And of course, Carol's pointing it out. The timeline doesn't hold up. The lawsuit wasn't filed when the committee subpoenaed the documents. So we know the lawsuit isn't about the law or the principle. The lawsuit is about what's in the documents. As Carol Lennick says, he's seen what's in the documents. The lawsuit was filed today. He's seen it for a long time. And I guess my question for you, I know, and I don't know if all of our viewers know this, but the way small children play house or play military or play firehouse, Donald Trump plays president. He is in this charade where he hasn't actually lost in the largest, most secure election in modern history. But part of playing president is sort of this phony exertion of executive privilege. And I wonder if you think it's just a loser in court where he's filed this suit.
Now, he's not banking on it being a loser. He's banking it on taking time. And the reason he did bring it now, something did happen to trigger it. Under the legal scheme, the archivist of the United States, no one's ever heard of, David Ferrero, gave him 30 days notice last Wednesday and said, Biden has told me that there's no executive privilege here. And as Carol says, that should be definitive. And I'm going to be turning it over. Here's your 30 days to look at it. He's determined that he's got to try to somehow stop the music and get the courts involved now before it gets turned over, because once it's in Congress's hands, it's going to be too late. So on the merits, yeah, it's a sort of desperate ploy that recycles arguments that already were lousy when he was president, like Congress is outside of its legislative function or the executive privilege determination is wrong. But the play here is to get it gummed up in the courts, and the big motion that will be coming soon will be to stay, will be to a court to order the administrator, don't turn it over. If that fails, The court could easily say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'll listen to your claim, but I'm not going to stay the music. Then things will proceed. If it doesn't, and he's able to gum it up, then, of course, we're looking at the sort of slow roll that was so decisive and undermining last time around during the impeachments.
Harry, how long could they gum it up in that second scenario?
18 months, 2 years, until it gets, whoever has the stay, it's as we've seen in Texas, Nicole, whoever gets the power of the stay and says, I'm freezing things or I'm not. If a district court freezes things, now we're in the courts and Congress is blocked, and the D.C. Circuit and the Supreme Court as well. If they don't, then even if they're looking at the merits, the January 6th committee will have the documents according to the scheme under law, and they'll be able to proceed.
Carol, it seems that because Republicans obstructed the bipartisan commission, which would have had an end date, no matter how long it takes, it sounds like the select committee will obtain these documents either way. This version, this select committee, does not have an end date, does it?
You know, I can't answer that question with any authority. I'm sorry. I think your theory is absolutely right. But I think the stall element that Harry's raising is a pretty powerful one, because if you can, as we all know, Don McGahn never had to sit for a subpoena for a very long time. It was almost like people had forgotten what he was being questioned about by the time anybody was ruling on whether or not he could be interviewed in behind closed doors. That's the White House counsel who gave evidence to Robert Mueller indicating that then President Trump had engaged multiple times in obstructing a criminal probe, something that would get you and I indicted, but does not lead to the prosecution of a sitting president. But it's politically very painful information. And my question has to be to everybody and to the archivist, what's the politically, and to the Trump campaign, what's the politically painful information in the documents you've now had sent to you for review after Donald Trump has insisted that nothing untoward happened here? Some peaceful, loving people came up to the Capitol wanting to stop an illegal steal of the election from him, and were welcomed with open arms by, again, loving, happy Capitol Police officers.
Just a tourist visit, according to Trump's allies in Congress. Carol Lenning and Harry Lipman, thank you for jumping on and joining us on the breaking news. We're grateful to both of you. Up next for us, private fears among Republicans, now finally 5 years into this nightmare spilling out into the open, that Donald Trump could be the Republican Party's worst enemy at the ballot box. That's next.
Go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Visit msnbc.com/app to download.
President Trump is the first president, in the Republican side at least, to lose the House, the Senate, and the presidency in 4 years. Elections are about winning.
You think that if he ran, he could lose the nomination?
Well, if you want to win the presidency, and hopefully that's what voters are thinking about, I think he might.
It's clear you ain't voting for him.
I'm not.
Aside from everything else we report about Donald Trump, he's one of the biggest political losers in modern history. That was Republican Senator Bill Cassidy saying just that, telling Axios he won't be voting for Trump in 2024, and he believes that Trump would lose if he ran. He's not alone. Many members of the Republican Party are just too scared to say it out loud, but they really are afraid that Trump will torpedo their chances in elections to come. New York Times reports that GOP officials are concerned that Trump's obsession with the lie about election fraud that didn't exist is a divisive force that could cost them seats in the upcoming midterms. Former Republican Congresswoman Barbara Comstock tells the Times this, quote, Trump doesn't want other people to win without groveling to him. That's the threat. It's not about winning. It's all about him. And that's what's so stupid about Republicans even trying to deal with him, because you never know when he'll drive the car off the cliff. Joining our conversation is Charlie Sykes, editor-at-large of The Bulwark and MSNBC contributor. Jason Johnson is still here. Charlie, the only thing I disagree with Barbara Comstock on there, she called it the Thelma and Louise thing, is we're already at the bottom of the cliff looking up from the wreckage. It's over. He's driven the Republican Party off the cliff. He's pushing through voter suppression and voter nullification laws. Mm-hmm. Frankenstein is becoming, you know, Frankenstein and his family. What keeps Bill Cassidy's sentiment from shaking, knocking some sense into the rest of the cowardly Republicans?
Yeah, well, if only they had been warned that this might actually happen. Look, you know, I think you and I had an exchange a few months back where I referred to this as hostage taking, and you pushed back and said, look, it's not hostage taking because at this point it's completely voluntary. I mean, this is voluntary self-bonding of the Republican Party to Donald Trump. But look, Republicans actually think that they are going to win. They think they're on a glide path to win in the midterm election. So they don't think that they're at the bottom right now. But they're looking around going, okay, how could we possibly blow this? Could we blow this by having to go along with every one of Donald Trump's crackpot conspiracy theories? Because that is what he is demanding. And again, I find this utterly extraordinary how many off ramps this party had to get off of Donald Trump. You know, Senator Cassidy is talking about how he lost the House and the Senate and the presidency. That would have been a good time for Republicans to turn the page. Instead, they figured that they were going to stay on board despite all of the experience they've had with Donald Trump's narcissism and his petulant demand that they toe the line. And I think they're going to pay a price for it. I mean, this is this growing anxiety. But again, how can any of them be surprised? They made the same decision over and over and over again, which is to kowtow, to pull the forelock, to go along with Trump. And he keeps upping the ante. And here we are. And so not a lot of sympathy over here for Republicans that are just now deciding that maybe, hey, what, Donald Trump might be toxic for our political future.
Jason, I disagree very infrequently with Charlie, but they're not off-ramps because they're not trying to get off. They're not off-ramps. Because if they were looking for an off-ramp, grabbing women between the legs would have been one. Good people on both sides of a KKK rally would have been one. Calling African nations bleep hole countries would have been one. Hanging Mike Pence might have been one after losing the House and the Senate and the White House. They're not trying to get off. This is who they are. And when do we just change all the models to say they are a pro-insurrection, pro-killing Mike Pence, pro-racist party? Let's vote.
Yeah, and here's the other thing, Nicole. Not only are Republicans not trying to get off the Trump train, they're fighting and scalping tickets to get on it. I mean, look at Herschel Walker in Georgia right now trying to do fundraisers with Trump. Look at what's just happening with Larry Elder out in California. Look at what Abbott is doing in Texas. The people who are running right now, who are Republicans, are lining up to get as Trumpish as possible. Now, does that hurt you in swing states? Yes. I was just at a rally for Terry McAuliffe in Northern Virginia yesterday, and it merely saying the name Trump gets everybody to boo. It's like saying Washington football team around here. Like, people will boo the moment that you say it. You know, Trump doesn't work for swing states. But if you're a Republican, that's the name you say for the nomination. We've got to stop pretending that Republicans are conflicted about this because one or two guys says, well, maybe he went a little too far. People tried to kill you in January because that guy sent them. If that doesn't make you quit him, nothing will.
Yeah, I mean, and Charlie, I didn't mean to pick on you, but just this idea that people like Cassidy populate the sort of most vibrant parts of the Republican Party is what I take issue with. They don't.
No, they don't. But Cassidy is a United States senator. He was one of those United States senators that voted to remove Donald Trump from office.
To convict him.
We need to remember that there were convict him. You know, and I keep thinking about You know, you and I are both old enough to remember when people thought that maybe Colin Powell was the future of the Republican Party. Instead, I think he was a very early ex-Republican because I think he saw which way the Republican Party was going. So you did have two roads that could have been taken. Yeah. And this is a rather dramatically different one. But for the Republicans who are privately, you know, sharing their concerns, I mean, that's gotten way, way, way old. And, you know, I remember 5 years ago warning Republicans, if you go along with Donald Trump, you're going to own all of this. You're going to own every insult. You're going to own every slur. You're going to own every dishonesty. And Republicans basically said, yeah, okay, we're okay with that. And they've been saying it for the last 5 years. And now I think they've lost the muscle memory that tells them how to break away from this if they ever wanted to. But no, they apparently have decided that this is the party. They're going to go into the midterms. They're going to go into 2024 flying the Trump banner. Good luck with that.
What do you think happens, Jason? You think they take the wrong lessons from the possibility that they have some success? They seem to be good at that as well.
Well, Nicole, I think they've taken the right lessons, and the right lessons are you can rally people around a lie based on white supremacy and sexism and nationalism and homophobia and everything else like that. And a key thing to understand why Republicans are optimistic next year, even if they're, you know, sort of waving themselves and wrapping themselves in a Trump burrito, is they're going to cheat. I mean, they're just going to make voting laws throughout the country that guarantee that they're going to win. There are very few states right now, Nicole, where there is a very good, active, organizing Republican Party. The Republican Party in Georgia is in shambles because they haven't had to work in so long. They just figure that they're going to pass legislation and make it harder for Democrats to vote. The Republican Party isn't really ready to run a campaign outside of the Midwest. They just figure if we can pass enough voter suppression, wrap ourselves in Trump, and intimidate the other side, we can win in 2022.
We'll be watching. Charlie Sykes, Jason Johnson, thank you for spending some time with us today. A quick break for us. We'll be right back. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes during these truly extraordinary times. We're so grateful.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.